My name is Paul Weber, and I'd like to thank you for joining me on this teleclass today. Two other thank yous to make before we move on. Although I get the glory job of hosting the British teleclass series, these teleclasses are actually organized and made possible through the effort of three remarkable people: Maria Benelik, Lauren Tu, and Vanessa York. This trio actually managed to make me look good, something that's not easily done, and I'd like to thank them for all that they do. Lastly, this teleclass is sponsored today by my friends at 3M. There are hundreds of us listening to this teleclass today, but very soon, tens of thousands of others will listen to the online recording of it, and from all over the world. A great many of those are healthcare professionals from developing countries, and they are given full access for free. Now, that's not cheap. In order to make that possible, we enjoy the financial support of some visionary companies like 3M, in this case, 3M Canada. I'm very grateful for their sponsorship today, and I thank you guys very, very much. It's my great privilege now to introduce our faculty. Dr. Lynn C. Hulster is with the Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion at the Centers for Disease Control. Last year, Dr. C. Hulster and Dr. Raymond Chin authored a remarkably comprehensive document called Guidelines for Environmental Infection Control in Healthcare Facilities. To give the teleclass Introduction to CDC's Guidelines for Environmental Infection Control in Healthcare Facilities, I am delighted to present Dr. Lynn C. Hulster. Lynn.
Well, thank you, Paul, and good day to all of my colleagues in North America and elsewhere abroad. Today we will be presenting an overview of a recent guideline from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention entitled Guidelines for Environmental Infection Control in Healthcare Facilities. This guideline was released in 2003, and you will see it is really seven guidelines in one package. We cover seven different topics pertaining to prevention of disease transmission from environmental sources and materials. To give an in-depth discussion of the full document in an hour is trying to like presenting a lecture on a full textbook. So today's session will basically serve as an introduction to the EIC guideline, as we have come to refer to it in our office. The handout provided gives you the guidelines table of contents and a listing of the figures, tables, and boxes of information in the document. I'll comment briefly on the content of each of the major sections of the guideline, but more importantly, we'll take a moment midway to review how the content of one of the sections, that is the air section, how this material is used to work through an outbreak of airborne infection, particularly aspergillosis. And finally, I will review the performance measures, at least mention them briefly. These can be used to assess your facility's implementation of the guidelines recommendations. Slide number 3, entitled Target Audiences, will show you one unique thing. This guideline is very different from other CDC guidelines in that it is very relevant to very broad audiences shown in this third slide. One of our goals in developing the material was to be capable of bringing two key groups of healthcare professionals together and thereby speak a common language. We wanted to introduce infection control practitioners, hospital epidemiologists, laboratorians, facility managers and engineers, among others, to each other's area of expertise on a basic level so they can work together effectively to solve problems and to enhance patient safety. The EIC guideline has been welcomed enthusiastically by both nursing and engineering alike for this very reason, and we hope that improved communications can be a major benefit from the use of this document. In our fourth slide, where can I find the EIC guidelines, I give you the internet addresses where you may access the guidance. A short version of the document, mainly the recommendations from Part 2, appeared in the CDC's publication Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, or the MMWR for short, in June of 2003. The full text with all of the background information, the full bibliography, and the appendices has been posted to the Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion's homepage within the CDC internet site at the address that is given in this slide. The full text version incorporates all the corrections that were made to the MMWR version to correct typographical errors and so forth. And interestingly, the American Society for Healthcare Engineering is planning to print the full text version at some point in the very near future. We're hoping in the next months or so. And we will try to make a note of it on our website if and when that printed version can be made available. In our fifth slide, the one entitled CDC Contributors to the Guidelines, I wanted to take the opportunity to give credit to all of the CDC scientists and my advisor, Dr. Raymond Chin, who serves on the advisory panel known as the Healthcare Infection Control Practices Advisory Committee, or HICPAC for short. All of these individuals contributed their expertise and insight to the development of this document. You can expect that a guideline as diverse as this, heavily dependent upon a team effort, and as part of that team, we also had many expert reviewers in the various professions, as well as people who provided comment on earlier drafts of the document. And all of these individuals provided insight that was most welcome to the development of the document. On slide 6, the organizations in the U.S., this document was unique in that we tried to incorporate material that are considered standards in the U.S. This and on the following slide, which lists the U.S. federal regulatory agencies, material from professional organizations and government agencies was very important to include in this document. As some of you may know, CDC is a participant of the American Institute of Architects efforts to produce standards for the construction of healthcare facilities in the U.S. And the work from this group is reflected throughout the air and water sections. The second organization listed, which is the ASHRAE, American Society of Heating, Refrigeration, and Air Conditioning Engineers, also has a wealth of material for the perspective on ventilation and water treatment issues. And finally, the Association for the Advancement of Medical Instrumentation, or AAMI, is used almost extensively for some of the guidance on the area in hemodialysis. And as we mentioned in slide 7, the federal government agencies here in the U.S., the ones listed are regulatory in fashion, and it is clear that the EIC guideline is written primarily for U.S. healthcare audiences, but we feel that the basic science, the foundation of the material from the organizations and agencies, that science transcends the borders of countries. So colleagues in other countries can find the information useful. However, it is necessary to use the information in the context of their national and local regulations as appropriate. And with that, let's move to the air section. We will do slides 8 and 9, the first two on the air section. The largest section of material in the guideline is that of air. There is basically a short introduction to the major airborne microorganisms and a very basic overview of the major components of the ventilation system and their function. We have a great deal of information relating to construction and healthcare and measures needed to prevent exposure of patients to dust and airborne microorganisms. The other major subject in the air section are the engineering requirements for specialized care areas within the facility. The airborne infection isolation rooms, or AII, for those circumstances where infectious aerosols may be generated, or if patients with airborne disease are present. The protective environment, PE, is an area serving the most vulnerable of patients, such as bone marrow transplant patients, some solid organ transplant patients, other oncology patients, and finally another third specialized care area within a acute care hospital or ambulatory surgical center is those of the operating rooms. Okay, we will move to slides 10 through 12, which are box presentations. This just gives you an idea of how the ventilation and structural design standards from AIA and ASHRAE come into play. These next three slides show ventilation specifications for the specialized care areas. When we get into the outbreak, which is coming up very shortly, you'll see how some of these parameters are very important for preventing disease transmission. The information we have here, by the way, from the AIA is current with the 2001 edition of the AIA guidelines. In the first of the three slides, we have the specifications for AII, the airborne infection isolation areas, and the protective environment areas. The airflow direction is negative into the room for AII and positive to out to the adjoining space for the protective environment. The values for air exchange rates, especially for the AII areas, point out a very important reminder to our readers. Facilities need not retrofit existing buildings in areas to conform to current standards. Any facilities or areas that undergo construction or renovation, however, are expected to comply with the standards in effect at the time of the construction or renovation activity. Hence, the use of 6 air changes per hour in AII areas constructed prior to 2001, or you will see 12 or more air changes per hour in those AII areas new as of 2001. The second of the three slides, this would be slide number 11, give the specifications for critical care or intensive care areas and operating rooms. With respect to operating rooms, the question has been raised about surgical care for patients with airborne infections such as TB. While it is not feasible to change the airflow direction from positive to negative in these rooms, there are measures that the operating staff can take to minimize potential contamination of the occupied space with airborne mycobacterium. These would include the use of portable HEPA filtration units to help clean the air. Procedures such as intubation and extubation of the patient can be done in AII if possible, and then the patient is brought to the operating room, allowing sufficient air changes per hour to clean the air before the use of the room for the next patient. Scheduling patients for airborne disease as the last surgical case for the day is also helpful as appropriate. The last of this three-slide series shows specifications for anterooms. Now, if you take a look at the handout, the document that lists the table of contents, et cetera, you'll see that among the figures is a figure that gives you a graphic depiction of ventilation parameters for anterooms, and they can be any of several possible approaches to the engineering and design of the anteroom. I believe in the guideline it is figure 4 that will show you some of these relative isolation requirements for the anteroom and the patient care area. But you can see there is a variation depending on the intended patient care needs for the room and the structure and the physical design of the building you're working with. One of the, I think, most important parts of the air section of the document is that of summarizing construction issues, and we are now into slides 13 through 15. In these next three slides, we do highlight the major points relative to construction. Preparations for healthcare facility construction in modern times requires a diverse expertise ranging from architecture, engineering, administrative, medicine, nursing, microbiology, to name a few, in order to address the problems that are inherent with construction. We do strongly encourage the conducting of a risk assessment as an especially important proactive approach to renovation and repair projects. If you are adding a new wing or unit to an existing building, or if there is external construction nearby, or really any time there is a dust-generating activity in the vicinity of the care facility. In the next slide, this is now slide 14, you'll note that dust control measures listed for external construction are those that are intended to keep dust out of the facility. The buildings should already be pressurized relative to the outside, but some dust may enter through doors and windows. The first bank of filters or roughing filters on air intakes may need more frequent changes depending on prevailing winds and the location of the construction project relative to the location of those air intakes. Slide number 15 summarizes the major elements of importance to infection control during internal construction, renovation, or repair projects. Here we're doing dust and moisture intrusion control. It becomes more complicated as construction proceeds while healthcare activities continue in close proximity or the immediate vicinity. I think one of the most important parts of dealing with the internal construction problem is the preparation of the site and the use of barriers, use of auxiliary filtration as needed, and tack mats or sticky mats to help minimize foot traffic of, you know, tarting dust all over the healthcare facility. Patients and staff are moved away from the area as appropriate. One of the issues that came up in the discussion of the construction part of the air section was that of particle sampling. This is part of slide 16. In slide 16, we do have some benefits to particle sampling. And we find that this is a useful tool to monitor the performance of the barriers. The decision as to which type of a barrier is suitable for the project, we've found a number of our colleagues have developed what we call a matrix process that takes into account the duration of the project, the potential for large amounts of dust to be generated, the health status of patients in either the affected area or adjacent areas. The matrix process that I'm aware of has been found in construction education materials that have been put forth by the organization known as APIC, the Association for Professionals in Infection Control and Epidemiology. Once a barrier is installed, it's important to verify that the barrier is sound. One method of doing this is with particle counts using a particle sampler. Particle counts are always evaluated by comparison. For example, when verifying that a particular filter is operating properly, the comparison is made to a particle count obtained from the outdoors. That is, if you have a filter reported to give 90% filtration, the particle count downstream from that filter should be 10% of that which was obtained outdoors. When evaluating the effectiveness of a barrier, higher particle counts in the vicinity of a seam or elsewhere along a barrier indicate that a perforation or other break exists, and this would be your signal that the barrier needs to be repaired. What we'll do right now is run through very quickly an aspergillosis outbreak. This is going to be in slides 17 through 20. This, I think, is a good example of how the elements, the engineering and the knowledge of disease transmission and knowledge of the specific pathogenic agent all come into synthesis, so you can see how the guideline can be useful for dealing with outbreak investigations and remediations of problems. What we're going to do is look at a construction-related outbreak of aspergillosis at a U.S. hospital back in 1996. But first, I want to share with you why this is very, very important in terms of controlling aspergillosis. You'll see from the slides entitled Impact of Aspergillosis from 1996, you'll see that invasive pulmonary aspergillosis, while it is a rare event, it is very, very costly. When it occurs, it has a high mortality rate and increases the burden and strain on the healthcare delivery system. If your facility provides care to severely immunocompromised patients, it's important to have a heightened awareness for dust-generating activities or situations in which persistent moisture can encourage the growth of mold. It is quite a just enormous burden in healthcare when aspergillosis outbreaks occur. In slide 21, we have Hospital A. In this first slide of the outbreak, we describe basically a large hospital with an oncology center that was housed in a three-story building connected to the main hospital by an enclosed corridor and a set of double doors. An external construction project was underway next to the oncology center, and this occurred in 1996. This construction was occurring on the south and east sides of the campus. The second floor of the oncology center housed the leukemia patients, while the third floor was home to the bone marrow transplant patients. So there you have two floors with severely immunocompromised patients. The two units, the second and third floor, are connected with a central stairwell. Now, up until this time, the pressure differentials and the HVAC units within the center and in the hospital were checked monthly before the outbreak was ever detected. What clued them in to the fact that something was going amiss was the fact that they noticed a shift in positive fungal cultures from Aspergillus fumigatus to the more recently noted organism Aspergillus flavus. And this alerted the staff that something was different than what was before. On slide 22, the first of our investigative findings, the hospital performed a case control study to identify risk factors for aspergillosis, and they found that 21 of 29 surveillance, this is laboratory surveillance, identified patients were included. They met the case definition for definite or probable, and they were included for further analysis. Some of the early remediation measures that were implemented were change of housekeeping procedures to go from a dry dusting to wet dusting in the areas for the protective environments. And in the further analysis of the risk factor data, they noticed a clustering of patients in one area, and I'll show you this on the diagram slide. Additionally, while clinical cultures were turning positive for Aspergillus flavus, they had used some small volume air sampling in the area and were basically coming up with no growth. When they converted to the use of a large volume air sampling equipment, they were then working in a sensitivity level where they could pick up Aspergillus flavus spores. So unfortunately, the small volume sampling lacked sensitivity to pick up a spore of Aspergillus floating in the air, perhaps not at extremely high concentrations, but enough to potentially cause a problem for patients. On slide 23, which is the diagram, the case patients were found to be clustered near the central stairwell of the unit. There were also more case patients located in the southeast corner of the unit. This, as you recall, was the area that was probably the closest or in proximity to the construction project going on the outside. Since there was a clustering in that one half or one corner of the unit, that prompted investigators to take a look at the ventilation system and structural flaws in the building that might contribute to dust intrusion into this oncology center. On slide 24, this was the last of the investigative findings. It was determined that at least six of the rooms in the protective environment area, six out of the 25, were not properly pressurized compared to the adjacent corridor. And I have listed here three which were negative, and that gives you the range of the pressure differential found in those rooms. An additional three were neutral to the corridor, so there was no noticeable airflow from one area to the other. Negative would go from the corridor into the room, which for a protective environment is opposite of what you really would want. Additionally, they found that that central stairwell, which was located on the left-hand side of the diagram, it was also a positive pressure relative to the corridors in the bone marrow transplant unit, meaning that air was flowing from the stairwell into the bone marrow transplant unit, and that should not have occurred either. Additionally, and this is probably more important, is the whole oncology center was found to be depressurized, or that is negative, to the hospital connected through that corridor and double doors. And so any dust coming into the hospital, which is was not as aggressively looked at for dust intrusion compared to these other areas, any dust coming in to the hospital could easily have flowed from the hospital into the oncology center, and because that center stairwell is positive to the bone marrow unit, the dust could easily come right up the center stairwell into the area with the protective environments. So all of these factors facilitated the flow of dust into those protective environments, and that in summary basically bypassed all of the dust removing HEPA filtration that were in place for the ventilation system to the unit. So this intrusion of dust just completely bypassed the air cleaning measures that were reportedly in place and supposed to be doing what they do. On slides 25 through 27, we have just a summary of some of the elements that they put into place as a result of the outbreak. The authors of the outbreak investigation didn't elaborate onto why some of these ventilation deficiencies occurred relative to pressure differentials, but once they were aware of the problem, they set engineering about immediately to rebalance the system and get those buildings pressurized properly. They paid attention to the doors to ensure that they were self-closing doors. Previously, I think the patient room doors were not. Again, the housekeeping processes were evaluated, and they had gone to a wet dusting, which minimizes the dispersion of dust as you're cleaning the surfaces and rooms and areas. They took measures to seal the windows and to seal any cracks in the existing walls, to ensure that dust intrusion from the outside of the building would not get through directly. They closed nearby entrances and redirected pedestrian traffic. They reviewed the construction policy for the hospital, and they also decided at this point that any airborne sampling for microbial cultures, they would be going with a large volume sampling approach as to compared to the sampling methods they were using previously. One thing that they did also, again, this is kind of a controversial element compared to non-construction time periods, was as a temporary measure for the patients, whenever patients had to be moved from protective environments to other areas of the hospital for other measures of care, they used the N95 respirators temporarily for the patients to protect them as they were going to other sites for care. And this appeared to be helpful, but again, this was an outbreak situation, and this idea of using an N95 respirator for patients is being, to my understanding, is being evaluated now for is this a suitable measure for routine use when patients are being transported from one area to the hospital to another during periods where construction is not underway. Some of the other environmental measures that were implemented as a result of this outbreak, they did close that stairwell that connected the second and third floor of the oncology center. Some additional case control studies were underway to further refine the identification of potential risk factors that may have been confounding variables during the main part of the outbreak. And again, they reviewed their surveillance methods to see if they could heighten the sensitivity of those methods. One thing that they also elected to do was to use supplemental HEPA filtration to further enhance the air cleaning in the area where patients were present if external constructions were underway and there was some possibility that there may be some deficiencies that they have to remediate, and supplemental filtration can help as an auxiliary air cleaning measure. We will now move to the remainder of the document. We'll go through the water section very quickly. On slides 29, we have the subtopics in the water section, and again, it follows the general pattern as we had for the air section, where we go through an introduction to some of the major waterborne microorganisms, their modes of transmission, which is in slide 30. We have a brief discussion of the components of a water system, cooling towers, and then we get into some medical equipment that is connected generally to either your main water distribution system within the facility or pieces of equipment that basically use potable water as a source for their function. Additionally, we have some strategies discussed in detail for engineering approaches to controlling the presence of Legionella in potable water, and we also talk about water quality and hemodialysis. One thing which we try to make very clear in the water section regarding the mode of transmission of microorganisms in water is there's several means of exposure when you're dealing with water. It can either be with direct contact, such as encountered in hydrotherapy. You can ingest water, such as in drinking water or ice. There could be indirect contact through like an improperly reprocessed medical device, the inhalation of water aerosols in showers, or if you're using water as part of a medical piece of equipment, such as a ventilator, you could aspirate contaminated water if the equipment is not kept clean and disinfected as appropriate. In slide 31, I want to alert you to some updates on the air and water sections that are probably most easily found in the newly released Part 2 section of the Guidelines for Preventing Healthcare-Associated Pneumonia. Excuse me. You'll see the internet site where you can find this guideline, and a full text of the pneumonia guideline will be available probably in a few weeks. It takes a while to convert some of these very large documents from one word processing program to another to facilitate the generation of the PDF file that you find on the web. But do take a look at this updated document to see if there's been any updates with regard to protection of patients from airborne and waterborne sources of microorganisms. With the Environmental Services section, this is now slide 32-33, we have a variety of topics all pertaining to keeping what we call the housekeeping surfaces in healthcare clean and safe for patient care delivery. Basically, we review the principles of cleaning and disinfection. We do not discuss sterilization or disinfection of medical instruments. This document relies strictly on the topic for the housekeeping surfaces, like the floors and the walls, tabletops, surfaces that are touched frequently by hand, by patients, staff, and visitors. But we don't dwell on the instruments, as that is a topic for another guideline. We do cover some areas that don't get a lot of press, and that is carpeting, cloth furniture, flowers and plants, and pest control. This is why this makes CDC, the EIC guideline, kind of an interesting document, is because these are topics that we rarely encountered in CDC literature. And finally, we did try to pull this together and put this into one document. And then finally, one of the last topics in the Environmental Services section is the special pathogen concerns and cleaning and disinfection. We talk a little bit about the impact of antibiotic-resistant bacteria and some instances where you're dealing with bacteria that have a spore form as one of its life cycle stages. And we also talk a little bit about the environmental impact in healthcare with prions or prion agents and some of the cleaning measures that are unique to those groups of emerging pathogens is discussed. Just very quickly, I'd like to get into one little topic on the Environmental Services section, and that comes up frequently, and that is if environmental sampling should be done in healthcare. We basically feel that, no, not routinely. It's a very expensive and very labor and time-consuming process, and generally, sampling has not had an positive impact on reducing the transmission of infectious disease in healthcare. We do find that sampling, and by this we are referring to taking samples of surfaces and then putting them to microbial cultures, we find that this may be very useful, however, as a tool that can be used in either verifying the cleaning and disinfection of a surface is effective in reducing the microbial burden on a surface. It is helpful in identifying environmental reservoirs for microorganisms that might occur during an outbreak situation. And if sampling is undertaken, it's important that this activity be coordinated with the laboratory either to make arrangements for suitable materials and expertise, whether it be in-house or outside with an outside laboratory firm. Now, that leads us directly to the next section, which are the next two slides, and that is environmental sampling. Because if you're going to engage in sampling, it's important that you have a feel for how it is done so that your results you obtain are meaningful and can be interpreted correctly in the context where the sampling occurs. So to that end, we are examining the principles of environmental sampling as well as the tricks of the trade, as it were, when it comes to sampling air, water, or environmental surfaces. Now, this is part of the guideline that is probably one of the more textbook in its presentation, in that it's not something that is very very routinely put into practice, but it is helpful information when you need it. And in this regard, this is one of the services we hope to provide to healthcare workers, was a quick and dirty access to information that normally you find scattered throughout old journals and textbooks that are not easily readily in hand when you need it. So this is one area of the document which is a how-to, but more textbook style than guideline style. With slides 34 through 36, or actually 34 and 35, we're getting into more of the selected short subjects of the guideline. And among these are laundry and bedding. Eventually we will get to animals and healthcare. But laundry and bedding is a part of the environmental services, the services that are provided to staff and patients in healthcare. This is an interesting part of the document because very, very, very little evidence shows that laundry, clean laundry, contributes to disease transmission. But it is important to throw it into the document because it is one of the services where we do try to reduce soil and microorganism count to prepare laundry materials safe and ready for staff and patient use. And so to that end, in the laundry and bedding section, we elaborate briefly on each one of those subtopics, such as collecting and sorting soiled linens, the microbial inactivation that occurs during the laundry process. It's very interesting that certainly in the U.S. healthcare systems, hot water is probably one of the largest, presents one of the largest demands on energy consumption in the healthcare facility. And you'll find that many facilities will outsource their laundry service to outside companies. There are also questions about the effectiveness of fabrics and materials that have antimicrobial chemicals incorporated into the fabric itself or the material itself. And the questions have come up, do these help to minimize disease transmission? And the answer to that is not that we have seen. The use of these antimicrobials in these materials is largely for preservation of the material rather than actually having an impact in public health. And finally, some more specialized concepts in air fluidized beds and pillows and mattresses. The animals and healthcare facility section is also a very interesting one because this has not been addressed previously in CDC documents. We have found that there are a number of U.S. healthcare facilities that are asking questions whether it's appropriate to provide care for an animal in the human healthcare setting. And we have found that the medical literature has very little, if no information, to help with this decision process. And so this is basically a summary of where we stand at the moment with the issue of animal care and human health care facilities. Other very, very interesting topics in healthcare with respect to animals are the incorporation of animals into assisted activities or assisted therapy. And in some residential programs, you will see some who have actually the facility cat or dog as a resident there, and they interact with the staff and the clients, and these things are emerging health processes, as it were. Again, there's very little information in the medical literature on these. Most of what we had encountered were anecdotal experiences with animals. And perhaps one of the more decision-challenging processes is that of what to do with patients or staff who present with service animals. As you know, a service animal is an animal, a highly specialized trained animal to provide a service or a restore a function to a physically or disabled challenged person. And this is where the Department of Justice guidance became very, very helpful for us in the U.S. To address how the service animal can interact in the healthcare facility without posing disease transmission risks or other risks for unpredictable behavior or animal activities and violence, such as biting or scratching. And so these are areas which have not been addressed previously in CDC documents, and we get a lot of calls about this. And finally, with the regulated medical waste section of the document, this is one area where it is highly regulation-driven and will vary a great deal from state to state, country to country. Basically, what we were focusing on were some of the principles and the microbiology of medical waste and how medical waste may contribute to disease transmission. Again, there's very little evidence that medical waste has posed a health problem to the communities that generate waste, either within the healthcare facility or in the larger environment at the landfill or in the sewers. But nevertheless, there are perception-driven topics, and this is what is addressed in that section. I'd like to share with you very briefly, because we are getting close to the end of our hour, these last six slides to alert you to performance measures that might be used in conjunction with the guideline, or else the guideline-specific performance measures, and you will have a chance to review them perhaps at another time, specifically the Joint Commission standards, which I've provided primarily for our U.S. audiences to alert them to what's the current 2004 environment of care. But basically, in the slide entitled EIC Guideline Performance Measures, as you might guess, there is interest in CDC and other guidance generating organizations to have some measure to by which you determine the effectiveness of implementing the guideline materials. In our document, we have several challenges. The first is that with seven different topics, you can't build a performance measuring process easily around seven different topics. The other problem is many of the disease processes you're hoping to prevent with the environmental guideline are rare events, and so it's very difficult to measure them very easily. Consequently, we have five measures that a hospital or a healthcare facility may use to evaluate the effectiveness of implementing the guideline. And those five performance measures are summarized here, but they're reprinted verbatim in the handout that is provided. And you'll see that they are focused on some areas where there is either a surveillance program underway or else there is something that can easily be documented, such as involving infection control in the construction development process for a healthcare facility. And those are the elements that we've chosen to help you determine how effectively the guideline applies to your healthcare setting. And finally, the last four of this series of slides, again, gives you the Joint Commission on Accrediting Healthcare Organizations, the Joint Commission as we call that, gives you their standards for the environment of care. They're more directed at security, fire safety, and emergency management systems and utilities performance than the Environmental Infection Control Guideline. But the desired outcome for both groups, that CDC and Joint Commission, is to enhance patient safety and staff safety, patient well-being, staff well-being, and to improve the overall quality of care. So there we have it, folks. That was your very, very brief introduction to a very big document. And with that, well, I think we have just maybe about 5 minutes for some questions or comments. So well, here we are.
Thank you, Dr. C. Helstrith. Thank you very much for that. There's obviously a great deal more to be said on this guideline. Hopefully we'll be able to explore it in greater depth in our 2005 teleclass series. One of the privileges of being the teleclass host is that I get to ask the first and sometimes the only question. Does your guideline or do you have an opinion on the efficacy of fogging a disinfectant, particularly in the case of, say, a Norwalk outbreak or something like that?
That's an excellent question. And our general feel of that issue is fogging, under those circumstances, is probably not effective, and I say probably not because each situation has its own unique factors related to the structure or the space that is being fogged. First of all, if you are fogging with the use of a formaldehyde-type compound, that is a carcinogenic compound. In the U.S., it is not registered by the Environmental Protection Agency or is no longer registered for that purpose, so that puts that off limits. But it is a hazardous chemical and should be used only under very, very restrictive conditions. For a phenolic or a quaternary ammonium compound, we've not really seen that this will be a beneficial feature simply because, first of all, for fogging to be beneficial, the area which is to be fogged really needs to be totally sealed off, and that means sealing all the cracks, crevices, sealing the air intakes, the air exhausts of the space, and then once fogging occurs, then you have to find a way to ventilate the space to get rid of the residual chemical in that airspace. The problem with all that is the moment the room is or the space is opened up to ventilation, you've basically introduced airborne dust, microorganisms, and so forth back into the space, so it wasn't really that effective in the long run. For norovirus, I would be more concerned with either foodborne or hand transfer from fecal origins more than I would of airspace, and certainly with norovirus, I would be also potentially more concerned with the transmission from an infected person through a form of direct contact where you're within, say, approximately 3 feet or a meter from one person to another, more so than just the airborne spread of the agent akin to, like, tuberculosis or aspergillosis. So the basic answer is no, I think fogging is really a very inefficient and not very effective method of control.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you again to 3M Canada for their sponsorship of this teleclass today. My thanks as well to Dr. C. Hulster, and a special thanks to all of you for joining me. Until we meet again, stay safe. Goodbye.